have also seen condemnation from other countries, including Cuba as well.
The Venezuelan government criticized the U.S. for acting irrationally, saying the blockade is designed to steal the riches that belong to the homeland. Donald Trump announced the blockade on his social media account, alleging, without providing evidence, that Venezuela is using oil revenues to fund drug trafficking and other crimes. He vowed to continue expanding the U.S. military presence until Venezuela hands over what he described as American oil, land, and assets.
Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. It will only get bigger, and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before until such time as they return to the United States of America all of the oil, land, and other assets that they previously stole from us.
Hours before Trump's announcement, Maduro praised Venezuelans for resisting the U.S. pressure.
So, all oil workers and all workers in the country must organize the strength of the working class in all ports in the world, throughout all the international working class, to protest against piracy of those who believe they have a letter of marque to steal the merchandises of the world. The workers should say no to piracy.
The latest escalation follows the U.S. seizure of an oil tanker off Venezuela on December 10th. In response, Venezuela has sent a formal letter to the U.N. Security Council criticizing Washington for maritime piracy.
The government of Venezuela demands that the government of the United States of America immediately and unconditionally release the kidnapped crew. Venezuela respectfully urges the Security Council to, first, publicly condemn this act of state-sponsored piracy, the unlawful use of military force against a private vessel, and the theft of a cargo resulting from illicit international trade.
The U.S. military campaign in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific has killed scores of people since September. Many analysts believe that the strikes, carried out under the pretext of drug trafficking, are actually aimed at ousting the Venezuelan government. This is also somehow revealed by White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles. She has suggested that Trump wants to keep on blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle. This contradicts the Trump's administration official stance that targeting vessels is in line with combating drug trafficking and not regime.
We're going to further dive into this issue. We have international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Also, we have geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson, who's with us from Seoul, South Korea. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Grossman in Bali. Washington Caracas saga keeps taking a darker turn as each week passes by. What are your thoughts on the recent stance coming from the Trump administration designating Venezuela's government as a foreign terror organization?
Well, I mean, look, Mr. President Trump continues to get more and more incoherent. And while it would be convenient to simply blame him, we have to bear in mind that there's no shortage of others, including numerous Democrats, standing in the way of getting their house in order. Six Democrats recently voted to defeat the latest attempt to have Trump impeached. Overwhelmingly, Democrats voted in support of granting a substantial increase in military aid to Israel. But this really sets a new nadir for Lunas. His terminology is bizarre. There's no supporting facts. The notion that Venezuela has somehow stolen American oil fields and is stealing American oil and gas is the sort of stuff that if anyone else said it, they would be certified and locked away in a mental institution. To designate the government of a country, the democratically elected government of a country, as a terrorist organization is absurd. The normal approach taken is to talk about state sponsors of terrorism. But even that obviously doesn't apply because Venezuela is not involved in anything that could be called terrorism, quite the opposite. So this is all completely insane, and it sort of beggars belief that the rest of the Atlantic world is just sitting quiet, letting all this unfold because they either support this mentality, this kind of fascist ideology, or they're afraid to say anything lest they be targeted by Trump in a fit of rage one night with additional sanctions or tariffs or God only knows what.
Ryan Dawson, I want to get your thoughts on the issue as well. As Mr. Grossman just alluded to, the democratically elected government of a country has now been designated as a terrorist organization. Oil tankers have been seized. Now they're being totally sanctioned. Vessels and boats are being attacked and obliterated without having any information about them divulged. As Mr. Grossman says, this is totally insane. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, so it's a perplexing question. How did our oil get under their sand? The designation, it is crazy to designate Venezuela as a terrorist state. They haven't committed any acts of terrorism. On the contrary, it's pure projection, because the only acts of terrorism, blowing up fishing boats, for example, has been committed by the United States against Venezuela. But legally, there's a reason why he is calling them a terrorist state. It's because now there's no process, there's no congressional oversight. If he wants to do airstrikes on a whim in Venezuela, he can, because now he's fighting terrorism, so he doesn't have to get permission to do Hegseth-level crazy attacks on boats, on airfields, on whatever he has in mind. Seizing oil tankers, I mean, that is an act of piracy. The United States, the CIA should be dubbed a terrorist organization, but this is just what they do, is they label their enemies terrorists. But it was an interesting shift. But the original propaganda was about narco traffic, and now Venezuela is a terrorist state, although they have no acts of terrorism to point to that they're even blaming on Venezuela, other than supposedly oil in Venezuela, in Venezuelan land and water, somehow belongs to the United States. But legally, the reason that they're being called a terrorist state is not because they've committed any acts of terror, but because it allows Donald Trump or the president to circumvent any kind of oversight from legislative bodies, where if there was airstrikes or naval strikes or declaration of war.
Thanks a lot. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Thanks to international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us from Bali, Indonesia, and also thanks to geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea. Elsewhere, the civilian death toll in Gaza continues to rise as Israeli forces press ahead with their blatant violations of the ceasefire agreement. Half a dozen Palestinians were injured by Israeli forces' live fire on Tuesday, while two new bodies were recovered from under the rubble. The total number of civilian fatalities since the beginning of the ceasefire now surpasses 390. The overall death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 is near 70,670, with more than 171,150 others injured. Meanwhile, civil defense teams continue to recover more bodies trapped under the rubble, despite extremely difficult conditions on the ground. Gaza officials say they are working with very limited equipment, including a single bulldozer and excavator. Humanitarian conditions are also deteriorating across Gaza amid harsh winter weather and torrential rain. Severe storm has so far caused several buildings to collapse on their residents, including Gaza City, causing injuries. Another Israeli soldier has taken his own life at a military base in the occupied Palestinian territories. This adds to the rising number of suicides among Israeli forces. The Israeli military confirmed that the soldier was first wounded and later died at a hospital. The case reflects a broader crisis within the Israeli military. According to a report by the Knesset Research and Information Center, around 280 Israeli soldiers attempted to commit suicide from the start of 2024 to July 2025. The report says there's been one death by suicide for every seven attempts. Different reports have also revealed that the invading regime's troops in Gaza have faced mental health problems. Demonstrations continue in the UK in solidarity with the hunger-striking activists linked to the banned direct action group Palestine Action amid a near-media blackout. One such demonstration was supposed to take place outside the BBC, but was forced by police to relocate over what the demonstrators called spurious reasons, Saeed Puruza reports.
They were supposed to gather outside the public broadcaster, the BBC, but at the last minute, a change of plans imposed by the Metropolitan Police.
Only moments before the protest would have gotten underway outside the BBC, the Metropolitan Police intervened, and imposed Section 14 of the controversial Public Order Act, saying on their X account that we assessed that the protests would have caused serious disruption to the lives of Jewish Londoners attending a nearby synagogue and a private Hanukkah event in the immediate vicinity. They asked the protesters to move from there and relocate here on Marble Arch. They've also banned the demonstrators from assembling on Trafalgar Square or anywhere near the residence of Prime Minister Keir Starmer. That's 10 Downing Street.
Why outside the BBC? To call out, they say, the public broadcaster's coverage or lack thereof of the hunger strikers, linked to direct action group Palestine Action, some of whom have now gone without food for weeks.
The BBC have totally ignored what's happening with the hunger strikers. They are complicit with the government in silencing the situation that the hunger strikers are in. They're now in day 45. They're in a very perilous situation. They could die at any moment, any one of them.
The reporting of the entire genocide has been disgraceful, and this is just part of that as well. I think they decided that they couldn't really smear the protesters and the hunger strikers, so they just decided not to cover it until, like, last week.
These are the activists you don't see on British TV channels, young men and women who have put their lives on the line to save Palestinian lives. It's not the first time such protests are restricted. Metropolitan police have forced national Palestine solidarity marches that would have originated near the BBC to move on alternative routes, claiming they caused disturbances to a nearby synagogue.
We know it's a complete lie when the police tries to cancel our demonstrations, to police where and where we can't go, because, you know, no one believes this lie of supporting Palestine, being an anti-Zionist, is anti-Semitic. I mean, that's totally cliche, right? It's been 2 years of genocide. The only people who believe in that now are hardened Zionists who want to see the Palestinian people exterminated.
And it appears that the recent Bondi Beach gun attack in Australia and Israeli officials taking to British airwaves repeating the hate march hoax has given the police the perfect excuse to shut down marches like this one. Saipur is up London.
U.S. President Donald Trump has widened his travel ban, extending immigration restrictions to 7 more countries. The move bars people of the targeted nations from entering the U.S. They include Palestinian Authority passport holders. The newly announced restrictions bring to 40 the total number of countries whose citizens face entry restrictions to the U.S. This comes as Trump, who is criticized at home and overseas for immigration crackdown, ordered mass deportations, and adopted an increasingly strident tone against non-white new Americans. At a rally last week, Trump said the U.S. was only taking people from countries he described in a derogatory term and should instead seek immigrants from Norway and Sweden. And the unemployment rate in the U.S. has increased to 4.6%, making it the highest level since October 2021. New figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that the number of jobless people in the U.S. stood at over 7.8 million in November. While the U.S. economy added 64,000 jobs last month, some 105,000 jobs had been lost in October. The Federal Reserve cut interest rates last week for the third time this year. That's why there's disagreement among policymakers on how the Fed should strike a balance between its response to a weakening job market and curbing inflation. In London, a number of Bahraini expatriates have gathered to mark Martyrs Day, which falls on December 17th. The people of Bahrain have been commemorating the day since 1994, when two Bahrainis were killed by the country's forces in the nation's uprising. Let's now listen to the Bahraini expats in the British capital talking about Martyrs Day.
To the people, to the nation of Bahrain, is a day of grief. Is a day that they would remember, another testimony that this monarchy, this royal family, won't exclude them, and they could even punish them with one thing, that they keep their sons behind bars. And this is why we see people tomorrow will be celebrating the Martyrs' Days, and that's what matters to the Bahraini people. Two parties celebrating this day. There is the royal family, which they say this is the 54th anniversary since the father of the current king came to power. And to them, this is enough to be the national day, not the day that Bahrain became independent. That doesn't matter to them. It's just like something that belongs to them, and it doesn't. For the Bahrainis, are still stuck in jail. Today, the king claimed to pardon over 900 inmates. None of them include single political prisoners.
The UK government has historically and continues to have a very close relationship with the Bahraini government, with the Al-Khalifa regime, and this relationship manifests in diplomatic support and also through the provision of training and funding streams which direct programs towards Bahrain. And we know that these are complicit in facilitating institutions that have been shown to be abusive in Bahrain and contributed to serious human rights violations in Bahrain.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
ECOWAS leaders have wrapped up their 68th meeting in Abuja
outlining what they called far-reaching resolutions on regional security. They agreed to forge a united front to fight the spread of military coups, terrorism, and other forms of insecurity. The decision followed a series of successful military takeovers in the Sahel, including a coup in Guinea-Bissau last month. Earlier in December, there was an attempted coup in the Republic of Benin. It was thwarted within hours after the government deployed Nigerian jets and ground troops. Experts say the swift response demonstrated regional solidarity, but they also warn that ECOWAS countries must remain vigilant amid Western attempts to foment instability through further coups. Experts say several decades after the establishment of ECOWAS, the regional economic bloc has been unable to achieve full economic and political integration. They believe that ECOWAS must detach itself from its colonial past and avoid reliance on external aid. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
What good can ever come from American sanctions? Part of the answer now unfolding during Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's three-day official visit to Belarus and Russia, a trip that underscores growing ties among countries facing similar pressure. The dynamic on display in Minsk, where Araghchi held high-level talks with senior Belarusian officials. The two sides signed agreements aimed at expanding cooperation and further strengthening already close ties. Officials from both countries say mounting external pressure has accelerated coordination across political and economic fronts.
On political issues, our positions in international organizations and various forums are very close to one another. Resisting unilateralism and coercive measures, as well as policies of force and domination, has been one of our shared efforts. Together with a number of other countries that share this stance against American unilateralism, we have formed the Friends of the Charter Group at the UN. We have decided to increase consultations within the framework of this group and likewise our cooperation within BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Eurasian Union will be further expanded.
Together we have explored and developed very interesting frameworks for a political approach. Ahead of us are new decisions and corresponding projects. We are confident that as a result of today's agenda review, we will be able to reach deeper and more substantive conclusions and strengthen international relations and ties between peoples.
Abbas Araghchi expressed gratitude that Belarus had demonstrated solidarity with Iran during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country. However, the talks were not limited to political stances and international affairs.
Our economic cooperation is extensive and spans across multiple sectors. However, it's insufficient, and both sides are committed to expanding collaboration in trade, investment, and joint production. For example, Iran is a major customer of Belarus's potash, and it was decided today to further facilitate this cooperation.
As part of his visit, Araghchi paid homage to the Belarusian victims of World War II at Minsk Victory Square, a gesture highlighting shared experiences of hardship, now echoed in what both countries describe as an ongoing economic war driven by sanctions.
These meetings are seen as yet another step in strengthening friendly ties, with Iran's top diplomat pushing forward cooperation in various political, economic, and regional fronts. Mariam Azarchar, Minsk.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost five children, three of which are biological, two of which are adopted. They were orphans and we took them in and were taking care of them. The five of them have not been found, nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement
is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaire massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in the all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our release. They knew what happened. You remember in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that subject?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about four times the rate of South Korean workers. Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that, among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A historic day in Iraq, as the Iraqi government officially announced the end of the mandate of the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq, UNAMI, after more than 20 years of its presence in the country. This comes in the light of improved security and political stability, which will allow Iraq to transition from direct international support to managing its own internal affairs.
In my view, the presence or absence of UNAMI mission makes no difference to Iraq, especially since this organization receives direct support. Unfortunately, most of the so-called international humanitarian organizations have turned into tools controlled by the United States. The evidence is clear. We have seen repeated interventions in Iraqi affairs. UNAMI had specific objectives, defined mandates, and legal and diplomatic mechanisms. But what we witnessed went beyond that, reaching direct political interference and intervention in Iraq's political decision-making.
Despite UNAMI's long presence in Iraq, political analysts believe the organization did not fulfill its true role. Instead, it influenced and interfered in political decisions, failed to manage affairs effectively, and consistently leaned toward the American side, failing to convey the suffering of the Iraqi people.
The truth is that the United Nations, through its representations worldwide in recent years, has failed miserably to be a clear mirror reflecting the suffering of people. Instead, it has turned into a tool in the hands of the United States of America. In Iraq, the UN representative reflected a specific agenda and exercised a form of imposed guardianship over the Iraqi state. As a result, the mission was only able to achieve the objectives pursued by the United States while attempting to place pressure on the Iraqi state.
This is a historic day for Iraq as UNAMI's mission ends and a new era begins, one characterized by the Iraqi sovereignty and the prevention of interference in internal affairs.
A new phase begins for Iraq with the end of the United Nations assisting mission in the country. This doesn't mean the end of cooperation with the UN, and is aimed at further asserting Iraq's sovereignty without any foreign intervention. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine. This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration. The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them. Even during last Christmas, I remember how churches were bombed into rubbles.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel, Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine.
And their policies are neo-fascist. They talk about annihilating all the Palestinians, the women, the children, everybody. There's no reservation about it. And Netanyahu follows this partly because he's ideologically inclined.
With churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus and hundreds of thousands of people murdered, it will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Isa Kadhimi, London.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old. Okay, I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office, okay? Other countries through mass protests, like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up and nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people. people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low, and down from 40% as recently as March.
Because a lot of people don't believe in politics, don't address it, don't see it, but they do see what's happening in the pocketbook, in their own reality. And that's the first thing that people address, Americans address.
Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars.
Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, hello and welcome. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at some of the contents of Surah Ankabut. So now let's listen to the 45th verse of this chapter.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أُتْلُ مَا أُوحِيَ إِلَيْكَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ
Recite, O Muhammad, what has been revealed to you of the book and establish prayer. Indeed, prayer prohibits immorality and wrongdoing, and the remembrance of Allah is greater, and Allah knows that which you do.
So, in the previous episode, if you may remember and you may have been with us, we said that since the Prophet of Islam is now taking this burden, and he has to carry this burden of prophethood, he has got this heavy responsibility, and he is informed by the Almighty Allah of this responsibility, he is also recommended and ordered, actually, to take help from these two strengthening sources. What are they? اُتْلُ مَا أُحْيَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ Recite whatever is revealed to you of the book. وَاقِمِ الصَّلَةِ And establish the prayer. So, why is he to do it? Because the Holy Quran mentioned in the previous verses the stories of other nations and how their situation turned out in the very end. The Holy Quran is informing the Prophet that you have this responsibility for your people, for your nation, to help them reach salvation. And in your path, in your journey, you need two important things. The recitation of the Quran, and also وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ And establish the prayer. So, of course, since the nature of prayer reminds man the strongest restraining factor, that is, the firm belief in origin and resurrection, it has an impedimental effect from the indecency and evil. That's why it says, إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ Surely, and verily, this salah moves away and keeps away the people from indecency and evil. So, he who stands in prayer says, Allahu Akbar. He calls Allah higher than and beyond everything. He remembers his bounties. He praises, he glorifies him. He praises him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, for his mercifulness and compassionateness. He remembers the day of his judgment. He confesses his actually servitude to him. He seeks for his help. He seeks his help and he asks him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, to lead him to the straight way. And he refuges to him for the path of those inflicted with his wrath and those who have gone astray. غَيْرِ الْمَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا الضَّالِينَ, the verse says. So no doubt, there will appear a movement in the heart and spirit of such a person toward the truth, toward purity and piety.
Inna salata tanha anil fahsha wal munkar wa la dhikrullahi akbar والله يعلم ما تصنعون
So that's the power of salah. That's the power of establishing prayer. أقم الصلاة إن الصلاة تنهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر And we understand for a salah, for a prayer to be an absolute true form of prayer, we must see these results, we must see these positive effects. The one who establishes prayer, he certifies to the oneness of the Almighty Allah. He attests to the prophecy of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he sends salutations to his actually prophet, his messenger. He asks Almighty Allah in supplication, and the Almighty Allah will appoint him among the righteous servants. All these things create a wave of spirituality in man, And this wave can be considered as barrier against sins. That's one of the aspects why إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ. Indeed, prayer keeps one away from indecency and evil. But we have also this this ending part of the verse, وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ. Certainly the remembrance of Allah is greater. وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ. Allah knows what you do. So, this salat is a form of dhikr and remembrance. And this salah is repeated several times in a day and night. And when the man gets up in the morning, he is engaging in salat, in the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. And at midday, when he is busy with his material life, he suddenly hears the sound of Allahu Akbar by Muaddin, and then he ceases his current programs and hastens to go to him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. And even at the end of the day and at the beginning of the night, before man goes to bed to rest, he prattles with him. He makes his heart the center of the rays of the light of the Almighty Allah. And moreover, while he's preparing himself for establishing prayer, he washes himself. The man has to purify himself, sending away any unlawful things and anger from him. And then it is time to go toward him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Brothers and sisters, we have got more to discuss regarding this 45th verse of Surah Ankabut, so stay with us. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
I've thought of this before over a million times. Who would ever thought that it would be our time? I just know it, 'cause you're the one. It ain't a selfish love when I'm with you. Remind me of the love, so I know it's true. I'll just say it, you are the one. Won't you be my BFF forever?
don't you know it? You are the one. You are the one. Oh, won't you be the one?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27th, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. We had seen examples of such meetings up close in Tehran, Mashhad, and other cities, and we had heard about similar meetings in other cities. A group of people would gather together, recite the Quran, and that was it. Memorizing the Quran, reciting it in a continuous manner, and promoting Quranic teachings were very rare. However, the revolution helped us get close to the Quran. It familiarized us with the Quran. Today, we are proud that we are interested in and fervent with the Quran. We are proud that our youth are interested in the Quran. Today, if it is announced that there is going to be a Quranic meeting in every city of our country, youth will rush towards it in large numbers. You witness Quranic meetings in all cities and in various gatherings. They pour into these meetings and they listen to the Quran. These are things that have taken place thanks to the revolution and Islam.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who are interested in the Quran and in charge of Quranic affairs should not abandon this field. You should pursue this task seriously. You should not say that because you have reached such and such points, it is over now. This is not the case. Working on the Holy Quran is infinite. We should endeavor and work very hard. Everyone should endeavor and work in order to establish a close relationship with the Quran. All our family members, our youth, and our people should get close to the Quran. Memorizing the Quran is a source of getting close to it. Repeating such meetings is a source of getting close to the Quran. Getting close to the Quran has many advantages and benefits because it will familiarize us with those above-mentioned concepts, God willing. I hope that Allah the Exalted rewards you. I hope that He bestows His blessings and His mercy on those who have taken a lot of trouble on this path in the course of many years. Some of them have passed away. I hope that God will raise their position, and I hope that He preserves for our society those who are still alive. I hope that God associates our magnanimous Imam, who opened this path with his pure ancestors and with the followers of the Quran on Judgment Day. I hope that he makes us be among the followers of the Quran, God willing. Greetings be upon you, and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. Guiding me from all the
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to all our listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio. I'm here in the studio of Iran Radio in Tehran, announcing our program schedule for the next hour. Hope you will accompany us into the early hours of this morning. We start tonight's lineup with Minbar. You can listen to speeches on many different subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. That will be followed by our radio productions feature. After that, we have Spring of Truth, which delves into a selection of the statements and speeches by the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless his soul. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So brothers and sisters, we learned that trick of Iblis to make the dunya big in our eyes, and then after that, because it's impossible that I both see the dunya is big and Allah is big, I fall into that trap of many believers. For me, God isn't kabir. And there's a whole list of things that happen if Allah